Hello from Gilbert and Tobin. I'm Moya Dodd.
And I'm Matt Rubenstein, and this is The Competitive Edge, what you need to know about competition law in Australia and around the world.
Today, merger by numbers. Partner Elizabeth Avery and G&T Ventures head Xavier Keary joined us to explain the venture capital sector in Australia and what the new merger approval framework might mean for the power law, the unicorns, and the walking dead.
Founders come up with all sorts of amazing ideas, and some of them have amazing applications well beyond the ability of that startup to realise and can only really be harnessed properly in a larger company.
When you think about the way that VC funds deploy money over time and that gets returned back to their LPs, which can then eventually be recycled back into other funds, you do need to have an ecosystem where the exit opportunities are relatively well known and there's a clear path.
So the power law, unicorns, the walking dead, this is all sounding like a very expensive series coming soon to Amazon Prime.
It does, doesn't it? But it seems that we've ignored all kinds of zombitunities and gone for yet another merger, murder episode title.
You wouldn't believe how many movies and TV shows there are with murder in the title. We're talking Anatomy of a Merger, How to Get Away with Merger.
Merger, She Wrote.
Merger on the Orient Express.
Blue Merger.
Even the Thursday Merger Club, for those familiar with Richard Osman's recent series of books.
It could be the name of our podcast.
It really could. But Murder by Numbers is a pretty average film from 2002 with Sandra Bullock and Ryan Gosling in one of his first starring roles. It's about a couple of high school students who carry out a series of murders.
Oh, like creeping assassinations?
Just like that. The students are based on the real-life Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, who only killed one person 100 years ago last week, actually, but it was all very cold-blooded and gratuitous.
They just wanted to commit the perfect murder and thought they were entitled to do it?
Yeah, they were big Nietzsche fans, apparently. They thought they were supermen, the bad kind.
Well, that's a cheery start. I'm almost looking forward to The Walking Dead now. But first, Matt, tell us what's been happening around the grounds.
Well, we just had the annual Hotchkiss Competition Law Conference here in Sydney. It was attended by a lot of people who can't be identified, and a lot of interesting things were discussed, and it could fairly be said that a pretty good time was had by all.
This is the Chatham House rule thing again, is it? So you can share what was said, but not who said it or even who was there. And so everyone ends up using a lot of the passive voice.
The passive voice is often used. It can't be denied.
All right. So what can you tell us about the conference without breaking any rules or sounding too annoying?
Well, as might have been predicted, there was a lot of discussion about the new merger proposals.
And it was generally thought that the merger framework would be considerably altered after the changes were legislated? Hey, now you got me doing it.
You don't have to do it, Maya. But yeah, it was seen as a pretty big deal. There were concerns about moving from what's ultimately a judicial model to a purely administrative model, and whether the ACCC and especially the tribunal would have the resources they'd need to make their decisions in a timely way.
Even after the budget. And so far, the tribunal has only completed two limited merits reviews of merger authorisations since the current system began in 2017. Now, those were the Telstra TPG one last year and ANZ Suncorp this year. Do they expect they'll be getting more of them under the new framework?
That is the expectation, and I think it's a fair one since it's now kind of baked into the whole process.
And the limited merits review system does suggest that you should prepare your application with one eye on an appeal to the tribunal, doesn't it?
Yeah, since there's not much material you can add at the tribunal stage, any time there's a deal that the ACCC could possibly knock back, you'd have to throw every piece of evidence into the ACCC process just to make sure the tribunal would be able to look at it.
And the ACCC says that it wants to have all the relevant information from the start. But where do you stop? It could be hugely wasteful if you have to front load all conceivable evidence that you might or might not need, including on appeal.
That's right. And there was some hope or even expectation that there'd be a bit of flexibility in the process, some kind of cooperation with the ACCC, like there is in the informal process that we have now.
But it's a bit tricky to formalise that informality in a mandatory regime, isn't it?
It might be. There were also some questions about whether you should have to wait until the ACCC decides you have a competition problem before you make your public benefit arguments. You remember all this from the Rosedale interchange diagram a couple of episodes ago.
I do.
And there were some pretty strong views on either side, though I'm not sure that's something that Treasury is actually consulting on.
But it can't have been a whole conference about mergers, can it?
It wasn't. There was also plenty of AI.
Well, whenever lawyers talk about AI, they usually want to know when their jobs are going to be taken by robots. Did that happen here?
It did a bit. A few of the presenters had asked ChatGPT to summarise people's bios, but also to advise on legal prospects. So all that was fun. There was a feeling that we're still in the phase of trying to understand how it all works in the way that lawyers like to do. Mm-hmm. And that's complicated by the fact that even the scientists don't seem to know exactly how it works inside the black box.
But do we really need to understand how it works if we can see the kinds of things it does?
Well, that's a very good point. And it was suggested that, for example, if an AI tells you something that's not true, then that can easily be misleading or deceptive, unless you've got these enormous warnings everywhere saying, this is just for entertainment, don't listen to anything it says. And even saying that it's hallucinating may be letting it off a bit easy, when really it's basically lying to you.
It's like that case earlier this year where an Air Canada chatbot told a customer they had 90 days to apply for a bereavement fare after flying to their grandmother's funeral, although the actual policy was that bereavement fares had to be requested in advance.
Yeah, and Air Canada said that it couldn't be liable for information provided by its agents, including the chatbot. And the tribunal described this as a remarkable submission, and it found that Air Canada was responsible for all the information on its website, including the chatbot.
Yeah, well, you'd imagine that would be the same result here, including in relation to the consumer guarantees we talked about last time.
Absolutely. A chatbot could very easily mislead customers about their consumer guarantees. I mean, that's almost guaranteed.
And AI does seem quite easy to make fun of at the moment. It always is getting things wrong that seem simple to us, like how many rocks we should eat each day and what kind of glue we should use to keep the cheese from sliding off our pizza.
Yeah, it does seem like it can be amazing at some really complex stuff and then fall down at some quite simple stuff. But maybe that's us looking at it from a human perspective.
Yeah, well, if they really are simple, then there should be a simple fix. So it'll be fascinating to see where we are a year or so from now. What else has been happening?
So there's a new edition of the Rap Sheet newsletter from our competition, litigation and enforcement team, and it's highlighted some really interesting private actions in the courts, including the first litigation of a merger by a third party in what the team says is over 40 years.
So informal clearance gives you comfort that the ACCC won't intervene in your merger, but it doesn't stop any third parties from getting involved. Is this like getting around the goalkeeper, say Mackenzie Arnold, and then having your shot cleared off the line by Michelle Heyman?
I'm going to say yes. Here, the acquisition of clay brickmaker Midland by its competitor BGC got past the ACCC in 2020, and that was on the basis that Midland would have left the West Australian clay brick market anyway, so there was no substantial lessening of competition.
But Brickworks, in this case played by Michelle Heyman, has sprinted back from halfway and turned up on the goal line, clearing the ball and telling the federal court that the merger did lessen competition, including because she would have picked up some or all of Midland's business, but instead she was forced out of the market and off the field.
So this is how you do a sporting analogy. Right?
Thank you.
And of course, the new formal clearance regime will remove the ability for third parties to challenge a merger that the ACCC has cleared, except on a narrow judicial review basis. And that would raise its own questions about standing and that kind of thing.
Well, if you change the rules, you change the game. So as well as that being the first private merger litigation in 40 years, it'll probably be the last one.
It probably will. And it's already proving to be a bit of a headache for Justice Halley, who's questioning the best way to treat the ACCC's decision to grant informal clearance and whether he needs to consider all of the 65,000 documents that were presented to the ACCC.
Seems like a lot of work. But Brickworks are also saying that they're victims of a misuse of market power, aren't they?
They are. They're saying that BGC engaged in predatory pricing from November 2017, which is when the new misuse of market power provisions came into play. And that was by selling clay bricks below cost in Western Australia and forcing Brickworks out of that market.
So traditionally, for a case of predatory pricing, you'd need to show that there was pricing below some measure of cost, therefore at a loss, and even a likelihood of recouping those losses once competitors had been driven out of the market.
Yeah, and that's what the High Court said in Borrell under the old misuse of market power law. It hasn't really been tested under the new law yet, but there was a case where Garmin asked the court for summary judgment because there was no claim that it had priced below cost. There, the court said that it wasn't clear that you needed to show pricing below cost, or at least it wasn't clear enough for the standard of summary judgment, which is no reasonable prospect of success.
And here, if Brickworks could show that BCG had driven it out of the market, the court might just say that there was a purpose or effect of lessening competition in that clay brick market without getting too hung up on measures of cost.
It might. And it does seem like the trend of private companies bringing misuse of market power claims against their competitors instead of the ACCC isn't slowing down at all.
Well, there's also the Epic case against Apple and Google, which is still being heard at the moment, and a follow-on action from Engage Marine against Tasports, which settled with the ACCC back in 2021.
Yeah, and there's also a class action against Sony about its own game distribution policies, which is quite similar to the Epic complaints.
Yeah, and the lead applicant here is Jordan Kim Sinclair. What do we know about him?
Not much. We know that over about 5 years, he spent about $500 in the Sony PlayStation store. And that included a game, some expansion packs, and a bunch of in-app purchases in Fortnite, which of course is at the centre of those Epic and class action cases against Apple and Google.
And he's apparently representing a class of consumers who purchased digital content from the PlayStation Store, and also developers and publishers who sold their digital content on that store. And they're claiming a misuse of market power, exclusive dealing, and anti-competitive agreements.
Yeah, and they say that the prices in the Sony store are often quite a bit higher than the prices you'd pay for the same content if you bought a physical copy or a voucher from somewhere like Amazon or JB Hi-Fi. And that suggests that Sony has substantial power in the console gaming and the game distribution markets.
And that means it can charge higher prices to consumers and higher commissions to developers.
That's right. And one interesting thing is how quickly digital content has overtaken physical games that you might have bought on some kind of a disc or a cartridge in the past, or painstakingly typed into your Amstrad Color Personal computer out of a magazine, if you really want to go back.
This is personal for you, isn't it, Matt?
It's bringing back some memories. By some measures, over 95% of revenues are now coming from digital content, and it's similar in movies and TV series, by the way.
Can you even buy Murder by Numbers on DVD?
Only secondhand, I think. But you can download it from a wide range of digital platforms.
Of course. But while we're waiting for our download, is there time for one more?
There is. Sticking to the courts, there's been another federal court decision on regulators, expert reports, and legal professional privilege.
So I remember last year, the court decided that Optus couldn't claim privilege over the report they asked Deloitte to put together on their data breach, which kind of kicked off a lot of these privacy reforms, didn't it?
Yeah, and on appeal, the full court has just affirmed that decision. It's found that when Optus commissioned the report, its primary or dominant purpose wasn't to assist its internal and external lawyers to provide legal advice.
They said it was also for the purpose of working out what had gone wrong and how to improve Optus's policies and processes for managing cyber risks.
Yeah, which would be fine if those other purposes were secondary to the legal purpose, but that legal purpose really has to be the primary or dominant one.
So the new case involves Noumi, which used to be called Freedom Foods, which supplies specialty milks and nutritional supplements and has been investigated by ASIC for issues with its disclosures.
Yeah, ASIC was looking at continuous disclosure failures, breaches of directors' duties, and also false or misleading conduct towards stakeholders and the stock exchange. And Noumi got its lawyers to direct PwC in a forensic accounting investigation to work out what had happened.
And it later shared that report with ASIC as part of a voluntary disclosure agreement, which said that with a few limited exceptions, ASIC wouldn't seek to have any privileged information admitted in court proceedings.
But when ASIC took Noumi to court, along with its former CEO, the former CEO challenged Noumi's privilege in the PwC report. I guess there might have been something in there that he could use.
And this time the court found that there was privilege in the report. It had been created for the dominant purpose of legal advice.
Right, but it also found that when Noumi gave the report to ASIC, it had waived that privilege. And that was because the disclosure agreement allowed ASIC to use the report in ways that were basically inconsistent with maintaining confidentiality.
And specifically because the agreement allowed ASIC to use the information to go after people like the former CEO. So it would have been unfair to uphold the claim of privilege against the former CEO.
That's right. Now both Noumi and ASIC are appealing the federal court ruling. Obviously, if privilege can be waived in this way, then people are going to be less likely to voluntarily disclose information to regulators. And that would certainly include the ACCC as well as ASIC.
And the judgment looked in close detail at the terms of the agreement, so maybe tightening those up could address the issue.
Maybe, but it might also be hard for those agreements to guarantee privilege while still being as useful to ASIC.
Indeed. And there's a class action against Medibank Private for their data breach as well. Did they commission an external report too?
They did. Like Optus, they asked Deloitte to conduct an investigation, and there's an argument now about privilege going on there too. Medibank's arguing, of course, that the dominant purpose of the report was to obtain legal advice, but the class action lawyers say that the report was at least as much about public relations and stakeholder management.
And was that report provided to a regulator?
Apparently, APRA was involved in discussions around the scope and structure of the report, so we'll see what the court makes of that. But it may be a bit of a worrying time for regulators and the businesses that deal with them.
And the ones who write investigative reports too.
You would think. And like the current merger process and all of the follow-on actions we're seeing, you may be able to make a deal with the regulator, but it won't bind third parties.
True. But speaking of the merger process, Matt, you recently sat down with both Elizabeth Avery and Xavier Keery to talk about the coming reforms and how they'll affect venture capital.
I sure did. I learned a lot about venture capital from Xavier, and Elizabeth raised some really critical questions about the way the new rules could get in the way of economic dynamism and innovation.
Let's take a listen.
I'm here today with competition partner Elizabeth Avery, who will be well known to the frequent listeners of the podcast. And also Xavier Keery, who is head of the G&T Ventures practice. Elizabeth and Xavier, welcome to The Competitive Edge.
Thanks, Matt. Good to be back.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, Xavier, this is the first time we've had you on. Can you tell us a bit about the G&T Ventures team and what you've been focusing on in the venture capital sector?
Yeah, sure. So G&T Ventures is a specialist practice group within G&T. We work with some of the most exciting Australian early stage and emerging growth companies. We've built a dedicated practice aimed at servicing this particular sector within the venture capital market, because we recognize that Australia is incredibly good at innovating, creating value through new ideas. And it's a difficult journey to take these ideas, commercialize them, scale them up and bring them to market. And, you know, as part of that, you need people or advisors that are going to be able to provide a holistic sort of approach. And so G&T Ventures is effectively designed to work with these really exciting early stage and emerging growth companies.
And could you sort of in a nutshell describe the landscape of venture capital in Australia at the moment? What are the life cycles? What's going on there?
Yeah, sure. So over the last decade, the venture capital market in Australia has gone from what was an incredibly nascent industry to being a player on the global stage. So in 2013, we saw committed capital at something around the $350 million mark in these early stage venture capital limited partnerships. And that's grown to over $5 billion in 2023. So you can see the market has grown considerably. So if we dive in a little bit into what a venture capital fund is really trying to do, it's probably worth talking about the power law. So this is a principle that is pretty well known in venture capital. And to sort of summarize it, if you think about a fund, and this will be a very simple version of it, but if you've got a fund and it deploys capital into 10 different companies, power law says that two of those companies will fail, right? They'll be write-offs. One of those companies will be the star, and it's going to return all the alpha or almost all of the alpha on that fund. In the middle, you've got the other 70%, and it's going to be made up of roughly about 40% quiet achievers. So, you know, companies that are doing well and they'll make a nice return. It might not be these sort of outsized returns that people hear about, the sort of Canva level returns, but it, you know, there'll be a nice return for the fund. And then you've got another 30% that's the walking dead, the zombies. They sort of hit a point and they're not really going anywhere past a certain scale. And so obviously the VC funds are making the majority of the return off the stars, but that 70% in the middle are really important for them. Because when you think about the way that VC funds deploy money over time and that gets returned back to their LPs, which can then eventually be recycled back into other funds, you do need to have an ecosystem where the exit opportunities are relatively well known and there's a clear path. And I think that's probably a good lead into what we want to talk about today.
It is. So this all sounds like the kind of economic dynamism and the startup culture that the Treasurer and the Assistant Minister for Competition are keen to get behind. But it does sound like all of this is dependent on the process providing these exit opportunities. And as we know, there are some changes coming in the way that mergers and acquisitions are approved in Australia by the competition regulator here. Elizabeth, how do we think about competition in the venture capital and startup sector, especially when it comes to mergers and acquisitions?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. There's obviously a few elements to that and some of the merger reforms and the way startups operate in the competitive landscape, I suppose, will be affected by the process changes, but also potentially by the substantive changes to the test. We were relieved that the Treasurer decided not to adopt the proposal to essentially reverse the onus of proof on the test so that parties would not be permitted to merge unless the ACCC was satisfied that there would be no substantial lessening of competition. We perceived that as creating a real potential barrier to exit and therefore entry for startups who rely on venture capitalists to invest in their companies, and those venture capitalists have a choice as to whether they invest in Australia or some other jurisdiction which may not have such strict regulatory requirements. Now, that's not to say that we don't take very seriously the need to have the competitive landscape set right to facilitate competition. But if you go too far and tighten the screws so much that you create barriers to entry, you're going to limit competition because you're not going to get that startup culture and that ability to innovate and that dynamic competition that the treasurer is trying to foster. So we're very relieved that the onus of proof hasn't been reversed. However, the test that has been proposed, which requires the ACCC to permit a merger unless it reasonably believes that it would be likely to substantially lessen competition, including if the merger creates, strengthens, or entrenches a position of significant or substantial market power in any market. That would seem to broaden the current test. What is it? It's not a substantial lessening of competition because that's captured in the first part of the test. This second part seems to suggest that if you're big and you acquire a smaller player, the ACCC may be able to assert that it's reasonably satisfied that there would be likely to be an entrenchment of substantial market power. That's what I'm concerned about for startups, because those startups rely on investors and venture capitalists who fund those startups with the aspiration to make a return. They want to get at least their money back and potentially make a return. If they think that those exit opportunities are significantly constricted because any strategic buyer is going to have too hard a time of acquiring the business, they will simply restrict the amount of investment capital that they deploy in Australia and go elsewhere. So that's where I think that this expansion of the test still poses real problems. I do also have grave concern that a limited merits review process, which doesn't enable parties to fully ventilate and test those issues about whether there is indeed a material entrenchment of market power on appeal, is problematic. And so you've really constricted the ability to test the ACCC's processes and potentially made the test harder.
So do you agree with that, Xavier? There are a number of businesses operating in Australia that the ACCC has indicated may possess significant substantial market power. If those businesses are kind of off the table as an exit strategy, how's that going to affect VCs?
Yeah, well, at least the initial reaction from the venture capital community has been a bit of an alarm with these reforms. If we bring it back to the power law, right, we have these stars, and these stars can be snapped up as part of a trade sale. So these merger reforms can certainly be relevant there. But focusing on that 70% in the middle, a lot of these companies, if we think back to their beginnings, they're often product-led, so they're building something with a product in mind and a particular consumer in mind, whether that be, you know, enterprise SaaS or consumer-facing SaaS or something else. But sometimes they're a bit more experimental. They're building something where they might not completely have the monetization strategy locked down, or they might not completely understand what the end game is here, but they have a really clear view as to why this could be something compelling to build and grow and scale. And this is why we see so many companies pivot in these early years. And so venture capitalists, they take a lot of risk on this stuff. You know, they're investing in people first and foremost, particularly these earlier rounds. And they're betting on, you know, hopefully that this is one of their stars, but there's more likely than not that it's going to sit somewhere in that middle 70%. And for those companies, trade sale is the usual exit path. And the buyers of these companies, particularly in software, but also fintech and other areas, are the bigger players in the market. I mean, if we go and look at the software industry, it's often the very large global players that are buying up these pieces of technology to roll them into their own tech stack. And I think the merger reforms put a huge question mark over whether those strategies will be allowed. So you reduce the pool of potential buyers, then you're just reducing exit opportunities, which then is going to flow back to the start.
Yes. Then the other thing is founders come up with all sorts of amazing ideas, and some of them have amazing applications well beyond the ability of that startup to realize and can only really be harnessed properly in a larger company. And those larger companies often don't do innovation very well just because of the nature of larger companies and the scarcity of capital available to invest.
A great point. You've just described the reason that corporate venture capital exists.
Yeah.
They're effectively outsourcing the development of the idea or the ideation and scale-up phase, and then they can make these investments with a view to either adopting that technology as a customer or potentially being an exit opportunity.
Yeah.
So
preventing larger companies from acquiring startups on the assumption that the big guy could do it themselves is actually quite misplaced, because really they're pretty hard. So you're really stifling innovation.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, really, when you think about it from the economic perspective. You know, these larger companies, they have a particular cost of capital, which is geared towards, you know, the sector they're in and the sort of risk profile of these companies. And when they're larger scale, they're generally less risky. So you've got a cheaper cost of capital. Venture capital is probably the most expensive form of capital because it invests in the riskiest asset class. And so by pooling these dollars aimed at risky investments into these vehicles and allowing specialists or people who are expert in potentially picking winners to go and do this, you're creating a better or more efficient allocation towards these riskier asset classes. And it might be seen as even a second or, you know, third line effect of the merger reforms. But by doing this, the economic flow on effect is that you push the innovation back into the bigger organizations.
Or not at all.
Or not at all, because they just don't have the ability to harness this riskier asset class at their cost of capital. It's going to skew that equation.
And then I guess the creeping acquisitions, I think it just adds another layer of complexity and decision making, like a 3-year look back to try and figure out whether there's going to be a problem with this last one, and trying to count what's in the 3 years. That just seems like an awfully complex process, and just another barrier to an investor thinking about whether it's going to be able to sell.
If the thresholds are as the ACCC asked for in the first place, which was $35 million in transaction value or $400 million in turnover, is that going to be triggered a lot by the VC investments?
Typical successful exits are going to be above that level. I think if you're selling it below $35 million, it's either a very quick exit, you've built something up from being worth a couple of million, and maybe you've only had to raise a small amount of money. And, you know, even though it might only be a $30 million val, it still could be a 10x for its investors. But I think you'll find that most of the companies sitting in that middle 70% are selling at values that are much higher than that.
And what about on the way in, Elizabeth? Like, if you take a stake in one of these companies, would that trigger the merger process?
I think the devil is in the detail at the moment, Matt, but I think it'll depend on whether there's control as to whether you have to file, and then it would depend on the size of your investment. So theoretically, if you acquired 51% and it was worth $35 million, I think that may, unless there is some exemption, they haven't actually released the detail.
Can we talk about that a bit more? Because in venture capital, it's very customary for investors to get a level of negative control through, you know, veto rights, both at a board and a shareholder level. And so what happens here where we've got, it could be corporate venture capital coming in, taking a 20-25% stake in the company with a board seat and, you know, a good amount of negative control.
Because the ACCC has been interested sometimes in minority stakes.
It'll depend how big the stake is too. Is the stake going to be greater than 35 mil for a shareholder? No, that would be a big round.
Be a big round, but, you know, if we go and look at the top, there was 15 rounds last year where the amount raised was $50 million or more. And that was in what was the worst, you know, market we've seen in a number of years.
So depending on the details, there might be a world where if over a three-year period you invest in different competitors in the same market, that might be combined into a $35 million purchase price overall using the anti-creeping acquisitions mechanism.
I think they'd still have to be controlling stakes in each of them. So merely because you have 20% interest in five different competitors isn't necessarily going to trigger a notification requirement. What will be triggered, though, is the need to put in place good ring fencing protocols, so in governance regimes, so that there's no sharing of competitively sensitive information between the companies via the investors.
So you can imagine that an acquisition might strengthen or entrench substantial market power in a number of different ways, depending on your theories of harm.
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. And I think the recent thinking around the ecosystem theory of harm is particularly relevant here, and also for startups. So there may not necessarily be any horizontal overlap and increasing concentration in a particular market as we're used to thinking about it, or even a vertical issue increasing the ability or incentives of two parties who are, you know, sort of a supply and distribution relationship to increase incentives and ability to foreclose customers or suppliers from accessing markets. The ecosystem theory of harm suggests that a large company that has a number of activities in different, potentially related, but different markets can somehow entrench its market power by acquiring another product, not necessarily in a market that it's already in, but because it's somehow in its ecosystem, however you define that, and that the definition of that is really uncertain, that could somehow entrench market power. So this broadening of the test would have real ramifications for startups who are seeking to sell to larger companies.
So it'll be interesting to see how the government resolves this tension between a dynamic startup culture and a merger regime that may rule out a lot of potential acquirers. Elizabeth and Xavier, thanks so much for taking us through all these issues today.
What a great interview. It does seem like the merger reforms are aimed at a traditional view of the way markets work and the kind of competition we're used to seeing between rivals or potential rivals.
Yeah, but there's something a bit different about a landscape where the whole point is to get your business to a stage where someone else can take it to the next level.
Yeah, and that might not be an option anymore if that someone has substantial market power that could be strengthened or entrenched by the acquisition. What do we know about those concepts?
Well, they'll be quite new to Australian law, but the ACCC and other regulators have been talking about them for a while now, especially in the context of digital platforms.
Well, the merger test in the EU talks about the creation or strengthening of a dominant position, so that's probably the most direct precedent.
It probably is, though in the EU, you still have to show that strengthening the dominant position would significantly impede effective competition, which it often will, but maybe not always.
And if there's no prospect that these startups will be acquired by anyone with substantial market power, does that really promote competition, especially in the longer term?
Yeah, it's a tough one. And there were also a few questions at the conference about what kind of investment would have to be notified under the new regime, like we were talking about with Xavier and Elizabeth.
So the Treasury paper says that competition can be affected by outright control, but also by minority acquisitions, if they give you de facto control or the ability to materially influence the business.
Yeah, and if you compare that to the ACCC's current merger guidelines, they say that the legislation does not refer to control, but rather to the effect on competition. And they do say that holding a minority interest in two competitors could lessen competition through coordinated effects, for example.
Yeah, you'd think for notification purposes, though, they might have to be more specific than that.
You'd think. And the threshold is still to be determined, of course, so we'd expect that they'd put some more certainty around what even is a merger.
And meanwhile, ACCC Chair Gina Cass-Gottlieb has told Senate estimates that even though they're not getting the power to call in any merger they want, the thresholds could give them a similar level of protection.
Yeah, and this is because the minister will have the power to set out special thresholds for particular sectors.
And the chair also said they were looking at Spain as an example of notification thresholds based on market share, both at the national level and in any narrower geographic market.
That's right. And Spain's actually one of the very few countries that use market share for notification thresholds.
Amazing. They're also one of only two countries to win both the Men's and the Women's World Cup.
They are. The International Competition Network said in 2002 and again in 2017 that market shares shouldn't be used in notification thresholds because they're not objectively quantifiable. And the OECD's agreed with that. And now most countries have removed market share from their thresholds because of the cost and uncertainty they raise for both merger parties and regulators.
So of all the things to take away from the Spanish experience, we're going for market share notification thresholds rather than, say, how to win a World Cup? Are we going against the run of play on this one?
We are showing some larrikin spirit, I'd say. But we'll see what happens when the exposure draft legislation is released, and that is still meant to happen in the middle of the year.
So was that in the crystal ball already?
Well, it kind of was, but I also wanted to talk briefly about the merger between Central and School Bites that was just called off after two red lights and an amber from the ACCC.
Ah, so these are suppliers of school administration software, which schools use to store and access information about students and resources, to send information to parents and carers, and manage payments for excursions and things like that.
That's right. They're the two main suppliers in New South Wales, and the ACCC was concerned that the merger would lessen competition in the markets for school information software and school finance software here in the state. And it could have impacts in other geographic areas as well.
Well, it does sound a bit like an effective 2-to-1 if New South Wales is the geographic market.
It does. And less than 2 weeks after the ACCC statement of issues, the parties have advised that the acquisition won't be proceeding.
Sounds like they got called to the principal's office.
They did. But I'm thinking that under the coming merger framework, this would be the perfect opportunity for a net public benefit argument, because I've got both of these apps on my phone, as well as the app of the distant third place provider, as well as the lunch order app and the school zone websites, and I have no idea which one I'm supposed to use for what.
So you're saying that school software is a natural monopoly?
I mean, from a parent's point of view, I think it might be. Wouldn't it be great if there was just one app that did all the school stuff?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not from the school's point of view.
And don't get me started on the WhatsApp parent group chats. Those things are insane.
So is your prediction that we'll actually see more public benefit arguments now that they're an intrinsic part of the mandatory process? Or that there may be a case for allowing those arguments to be flagged from the start without having to wait for a competition issue to be identified? Or that you should just stay out of those WhatsApp groups.
Just call the school, Steve.
Call the school. All right. Well, remember, you can find relevant links in the show notes or email us at edge@gtlaw.com.au.
And we've got some great guests still to come. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell your friends.
Till next time, this was The Competitive Edge with Gilbert and Tobin.